Raymond?
Yes, the man from the insurance company dropped this off this morning. He said it was the only thing left from the remains of the fire.
Oh, thank you. Oh, I've never seen this before. Oh, they're letters. Here.
Oh, sure.
From John Cheever.
Wow.
Ooh. Dear Henry, last night with you was bliss. I fear my orgasm has left me a cripple. I don't know how I shall ever get back to work. I love you madly, John. P.S. Love the cabin.
Well, we really should be.
Hello and welcome to Gayest Episode Ever, the podcast where we talk about the LGBT-focused episodes of classic sitcoms, which is to say the very special episodes that also happen to be very queer episodes. I'm Drew Mackey.
I'm Glenn Lakin.
And in case that intro did not tip you off, today we are talking about Seinfeld. Seinfeld.
Excitement.
Excitement. And in order to discuss this show, we have a special guest, Mike Siriaco. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Mike, I first know your byline when you were writing for LA Weekly, which was kind of a long time ago.
Even before that, we both contributed to Frontiers together, didn't we? That's how we met each other.
Okay. And then there was that unfortunate subsequent project that followed Frontiers.
World Media?
Mm-hmm. Look it up. It's not there anymore.
In fact, all the Frontiers stuff is gone because when they swindled Frontiers, nobody kept up the archives. So 30 years mm-hmm. of LA's best LGBT publication, gone.
Well, I'm sure someone has just like issues stacked box somewhere.
I have every single issue that I've ever been published in. I just need somebody like Piper sitting in front of like a Xerox machine to actually make it into an archive. I need an intern. I need to be like Kramer when he gets the intern.
We all need an intern / personal assistant that we don't pay, which is what an intern is, yes. The loss of that archive is like a kind of a blow to like at least LA gay history, if not like American gay history, since we're the second biggest city in the United States.
And
that
was
around a long time.
It ran for decades. I think it was older than the city of West Hollywood itself.
Yeah, it definitely was.
It was like nearly 40 years old. So, yay.
I do think it was older than I am, which was like made it sadder when I realized that it was no longer a thing. And it's really symptomatic of gay media. Like Out had the same problem where they just weren't paying people for a super long time. And it's like, you fuckers, like you're supposed to be better on top of this. And it just makes it look like gay people don't have their shit together, which we don't.
Homo superior should be homo superior.
We're badly organized people, it turns out. I don't know how we achieved anything.
But we all have OCD.
We do, but not about important stuff. Mm-hmm. We have OCD about like decor and clothes, but not about paying people and keeping financial records straight. It's a fucked up thing. Anyway, Mike.
Yes.
Where else might people know you from other than your byline for once great LA publications?
Okay. So I'm currently the host of WeHo TV News, and I'm currently contributing to LA Magazine, and I am the Los Angeles correspondent for Queerty's Gay Cities.
That's awesome. What is Gay Cities?
Gay Cities is an imprint of Queerty that covers travel from a gay perspective. So I cover a lot of pool parties in LA, a lot of comic book conventions because I'm a gay geek. Mm-hmm. Just a lot of interviews with interesting people in Los Angeles.
That's awesome. As someone who basically, I don't work as a journalist anymore. I do this full time. When I see that other people are still doing that kind of stuff, I feel like a pang of like jealousy and nostalgia, because I really did like being a reporter, but I just don't do it anymore. Womp womp.
We got to find you a mystery to solve with your reporting skills.
That is what I should do, and then turn it into a podcast. Mike, what is your relationship with the TV series Seinfeld?
Oh my God. I grew up with it. So my parents were huge fans of Seinfeld. I remember I initially got into it when I was at my grandparents' house, and they lived in one of those retirement communities.
Like Del Boca Vista?
Exactly. Like in the first episode I saw, it just happened to be a back-to-back where it's the parking spot, and then right after it is when Jerry and Elaine visited his parents. And so I got all the jokes because I was living them real life at this retirement community.
Is that when Jerry buys the car for his dad?
No, it was way earlier than that. It's when he has to, I think Elaine or him, somebody's sleeping on the pullout couch.
Elaine. Yes. It fucks up her back and she gets to be on painkillers.
And she's stuck there. Mm-hmm.
And it's hot.
Yeah. Can you please put the air conditioning? You're hot? She asked incredulously.
We never talked about this, but Glenn's parents live in sort of a Del Boca Vista.
Yeah, kind
of. Has your memory of those episodes changed at all now that you've lived it?
No.
Okay.
I mean, it's really hard for me to look past just the politics of that community, mm-hmm. and make fun of it for just being a bunch of old people as opposed to a bunch of specifically old white people who are clinging to their privilege and taking it to their grave.
Deep crimson red.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a good way to start off a relationship with Seinfeld. Do you still watch it today?
I do. In fact, I was in an acting class with a kid who's 24. So already I'm depressed because he's 13 years younger than me. His entire bar mitzvah younger than me. Mm-hmm. But our assignment was to watch 3-camera comedies. I'm like, current stuff is shit. Let's watch the classics. And I showed him, do you remember the Susie?
Yes. The one with Elaine's fake assistant?
Yes. And one of my favorite scenes ever is when she is called into a meeting mm-hmm. by her boss who knows who she is. Mm-hmm. And this woman who thinks she's Susie, and she has to play it off as both people at the exact same time, which she does flawlessly. Mm-hmm. We should all go out to lunch. What? Coming, which I've used in real life. It actually does work. And then he turns to her and says, I love that woman. What's your name again? Fun fact, that dude is my ex-boyfriend's father's best friend. We're college roommates or something like
that. Jay Peterman?
Is that the the actor who played him.
Huh.
What game show did he go on to host?
He did go on to host a game show. It wasn't Family Feud. But he's done a lot of hosting things since.
A lot of voiceover.
And Dancing with the Stars, because that's where a recurring Seinfeld character should end up. Yeah.
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 Well, he did have moves. Where he busted out as a counterpoint to how terribly she danced at an office party. A year later, he's in charge again. He grabs somebody, dips her, and he's just so suave.
He was a very smooth guy. Is he like that in real life?
Yes, but I met him when he's way older.
Okay.
But he's still, it's that voice. It all comes down to that voice.
He has a great voice.
He should be on a podcast.
I kind of wish I could do the entire podcast like that, but
you can try. We'll see how that goes.
My natural awkwardness is going to come out.
What is your memory of this episode in particular? Did I say the title of the episode yet?
It is called John Cheever Letters. Cheever Letters.
The Cheever Letters. For the purposes of this podcast, I think we're going to call it Susan's Dad Had a Affair with John Cheever. I'm not sure what the...
Or just a gay love affair.
Gay love affair.
They're just celebrating each other's strength.
Yeah, that's the best case.
Did back then.
That's the best case scenario for John Cheever, according to the research I did on him. Troubled man. When is the first time you remember seeing this episode?
So oddly enough, I saw a lot of the episodes out of order. I saw as they were coming on, and then I had to see the earlier ones I missed because I was just too young. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those. I had already met Susan's parents later on. She had very different hair then. In fact, was it the same dad or did
same
they
dad.
Change? It was. It's just the beard, I guess, that threw me off.
And yeah, and he had the mom's hair got less big.
Yeah, she had that 80s hair in the first one. Same alcoholism.
Yeah.
That was
that's sort of the actress's go-to.
She's very good at playing an alcoholic.
Yeah.
So she's either a great actress or a great alcoholic. Either way.
She can be two things.
Yeah. Why shouldn't she be?
I remember seeing it way later when it was syndicated on PIX 11 or whatever they had at that point on the East Coast.
Where'd you grow up?
New Jersey.
Okay. Same thing. I don't think I started watching Seinfeld until the next season or maybe the season after that would be season 6. And then I had to catch up after the fact and get all this backstory and didn't know that there ever was a pilot, which they mention every now and then in later seasons of the show. But it was all things I discovered in syndication.
It's a big part of the finale, the series finale.
The pilot?
Yeah, because they revisit it. The whole reason they're on that plane to go back to California is because they're picking it up again.
That's right.
Full circle.
Okay, that's right. That's right.
But yeah, season 4 is brilliant because it's so well connected. Yes. Every episode leads into the next. They had a through line for that. It was surprisingly smart for Seinfeld, for somebody who pretends he's just winging it.
Well, also, I think it was the first season where they had sort of a big through line for the season. It was more yeah, it was more serialized, which is why it was interesting during that season finale when you got the revisit.
It was actually about something.
Yeah.
This nothing was something.
The finale for this season, when they air the pilot and you see all those callbacks to everything else that's happened over the course of the show, kind of plays like a better series finale than the actual series finale.
It was a curtain call at the end of the day. You saw the entire season's cast. They all had a punchline.
Well, I watched the
first appearance of Jane Leaves.
Yes.
Is that how she started her career, as the Virgin?
Marla the Virgin.
I think that was the season right before the first season of Frasier, correct?
That would make sense. I have a note coming up here later that so many of the female bit players on this show got leads on sitcoms on NBC very shortly after. It was like a springboard for
NBC is big about that, about nurturing. I mean, look at Lisa Kudrow. She started as a guest spot on Cheers. She got Mad About You. From that, they developed Phoebe just for her, because they originally wanted to use her character on Mad About You, and they're like, let's do something different.
For the best, that we don't need to see that character.
Fact, wait. Lisa Kudrow was originally the, I think she was Roz in the pilot of Frasier.
The unfilmed pilot, the unreleased pilot that I've tried to find and cannot find anywhere, but yeah.
If you're listening and have that pilot,
please send it to
me. Do you really?
Oh. No.
I thought you said you had it.
We just want it. Glenn, you saw this live.
Yeah, so I watched Seinfeld with my dad every Thursday. In the Midwest, it was on Thursday, my CTV.
What was it like to see an episode that was dealing with like secret homosexuality?
I mean, I'm sure I said nothing and I didn't make any eye contact and just like quietly ate my popcorn.
Okay, that makes sense.
But like, we'd watch it on my dad's bed. Is that
okay?
That's fine.
That's not weird. That's where a lot of people watch TV.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's a bigger TV in the bedroom for some reason.
Parents are weird like that.
They're trying to hoard it.
Yeah, they want to steal all the TV from you. I think your evaluation of the season is correct. And they never quite did it again, where there's so much of an overarching plot. It must have been harder to do, but like the episodes blend into each other very closely. And I, A, did not realize this is the Dirty Talk episode, and B, didn't realize that it picks up exactly where the Bubble Boy episode leaves off. The Bubble Boy episode is what ends with the burning of the cabin. Yeah. And then it segues into other stuff. It just all runs together. It's really, really well done.
We got to remember, Seinfeld's a comic book fan. What do comic books do? They bleed into each other. The entire fourth season could be seen as a comic book run.
That's a good analysis. That's true. This is a Susan episode. And Susan's a very interesting character in the course of Seinfeld, because she appears in a lot of episodes, more than a lot of other supporting characters, probably more characters than David Putty, who's Elaine's closest to a long-term romance. Susan is the most long-term romance anyone on this show has, because she's basically there for two seasons. And it's weird that of all the relationships on the show, this is the closest to a like full-fledged, like seen-through romantic relationship that anyone has. Jerry never does.
So my biggest thing about Susan is, what is wrong with Susan that she is in this relationship? Because he's an obviously flawed man. She goes back to him. She stays with him. My thing is, I want to delve into, what is going on? What happened to her?
I mean,
life?
You meet her parents.
Yeah. And her brother and aunt that we never see again.
Yeah.
No. I think we see about as much of the aunt as we need to
see.
I was good with that.
Oh, I thought was, what's her name? From the one who played Pat from SNL.
Julie Sweeney. She kind of looks like Julie Sweeney.
She had that look to her.
She's the ones in this episode. She's not really done anything else. This is like the one big thing she's ever done.
Huh. Maybe she's like dating a writer or something.
That would make sense. Maybe they, but like the flip side, we'll talk about it later, but that character exists. The only thing we know about her, other than the fact that she's a paraplegic, is that she allegedly looks like George. So do you think they put out a casting call for like an actress who kind of looks like Jason Alexander? And she was like, well, I could pass for that. And they gave it to her. Maybe that's why.
Yeah.
So my theory on Susan is that she essentially exists as a normal person who's going to show how awful the four main characters are, because her entire existence on the show is only seen through a relation through George and by extension his friends. And everything that happens to her is bad. Like they just like pick apart her life until literally she's dead and there's nothing.
Yeah, they can't.
Played by Heidi Swedberg, who is in Kindergarten Cop. She's the mom of that kid who's getting physically abused. And she gets mad when Arnold Schwarzenegger tries to call her out on hitting her child. That's Susan. And then she's in Hot Shots. She plays the wife of the pilot who's nicknamed Dead Meat, who dies. She's Mrs. Dead Meat. Those are like the two other things she's ever done. She now plays the ukulele.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, you know how she got fired, right?
I have that in here, and it's such a like, it's such a bummer. Actually, that's like the next thing. Before we get into that, I want to talk about every bad thing that's ever happened to her, which includes being vomited on by Kramer, Kramer burning down her family's cabin, which is this episode, and then by extension, her dad getting outed. George gets her fired from NBC because he kisses her, and that causes her to lose her job. They break up. They get back together. He decides he doesn't want to be with her anymore, so he picks his nose in public, hoping that that will disgust her to the point that she breaks up with him. I think she does. And then she ends up resorting to lesbianism is the way the show, like in the universe of the show, that's clearly like another bad thing that happened to her is that she became a lesbian.
It wasn't that she became a lesbian. It's that her lover was poached by Kramer and turned back.
Yeah.
So she got cucked by Kramer. I would say that's the bad thing.
And then we see her watching the pilot with, she has a girlfriend at the last episode of the season. They're watching the pilot to Jerry, and she has like a scene with a girlfriend. I can't remember who the girlfriend is. But then she comes back in season 7. George proposes to her. She says yes, again, because she has horrible low self-esteem. And then the worst thing that happens between that and the envelopes is that they send her parents on a hansom cab ride through Central Park. But Kramer feeds the horse chili, so it farts the entire time. And then Susan dies because George gets tainted envelopes. And do you remember how Kramer reacts to the news that she's died?
She doesn't. He uses the wrong name, doesn't he?
Says poor Lily. She doesn't even have her name at the end. They take everything away from her, and she's dead.
Does she ever have a standalone scene with any of the other characters other than George?
Elaine. There was a whole episode where Elaine tries to become best friends with her, and she just she leaves them. She just can't be part of it anymore.
Right. That might be it. She might otherwise just exist through George, which is a terrible way for anyone to exist. I say she's a tragic figure who shows how caustic the four central characters are. Yeah. So what do you remember about the story about why Susan was killed off?
Apparently the four of them were such a well-oiled machine doing like production of it. Great. Until they had to do scenes with her, and she wasn't as sharp as they were, wasn't as talented. So it would take them way more takes. Any scene they had, they're like, we just can't use her anymore. So they thought it would be hilarious to kill her off. And they were right.
They were right.
They were right.
It works in the universe of the show. That is a natural, terrible ending that meets with someone who was stupid enough to involve herself with these four people for like 2 years of her life. Like that's a natural outcome. Most people end up worse off for knowing these four people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember I was young, too, when that episode came out, and it was a must-see TV night. So I'd been watching, you know, from Friends to ER, and we're going to bed and thinking about that. I'm like, oh, fuck. They just killed Susan. Even like as a middle schooler, it occurred to me like that was terrible. That was really terrible.
Do you think in some ways it changed the tone of the show?
It's darker. That episode's really dark.
They always say the turning point, though, is when they mugged the old woman for the rye. Everyone always considers, like, that's when they became complete sociopaths.
And that is a Mr. and Mrs. Ross episode. Yeah. That is when they come back after this. I think that's their second appearance.
That's the second appearance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe it's the
Which
Ross.
Leads to the death.
Maybe it's
that's the same
fault.
Season.
So there was a woman named Jennifer Kyshen Armstrong who did a book called Seinfeldia. And it's just like a oral history of Seinfeld. And she talks about the conversation between Larry David and Jason Alexander, where he's like, we got a great art for George. He's going to get engaged. And he's like, to what character? Larry David's like, Susan. And he's like, who's playing Susan? And he says, Heidi. And then his response to that is, who's playing George? According to this account, he found her comic instincts to be the opposite of his own. I always felt like I was punching into Jell-O. He'd do a scene with her and it would fall flat. So the next take, he'd do something else, but then she would do something else and they just never quite gelled. And Larry David was like, no, this is going to be great for your character. And he didn't want it. So then he did this interview with Howard Stern, which is kind of where the story first came out. And Howard Stern asked about the rumors that they killed Susan because he hated her. And he's like, no, she's a terrific girl. I just couldn't figure out how to play off her. But then he Costanzas the entire conversation and he keeps talking. And you're just like, shut up, shut up, shut up. It's hard to listen to because he says, Julia's actually the one who says, I don't know, why don't you just kill her? And that is what sparked the idea for the entire plot line. After this interview where he divulges all of this, Jason Alexander had to do an apology where he said she was generous and gracious, and I'm so mad at myself for retelling the story in any way that would diminish her. To Heidi, I personally apologize. You are a sweetheart. I actually launched into this on Howard Stern to defend you. This is why I'm not a lawyer. Now everyone can just calm down, enjoy the reruns and think, why wasn't this working? And it's like, no, stop talking. It's not good. I'd like to think she's probably fine.
I think she's fine.
Yeah.
She's got Seinfeld money. She's fine.
That's true.
Every now and then, I can't watch Seinfeld without thinking about like, oh, all those people have so much money.
How much would like a supporting player, do you still get paid if you're like a bit player on the show?
I don't know. Ask Tony.
It's SAG-AFTRA. Of course you do. Okay. Well, that's how residuals work. Yeah. That's why we pay our pimp that is SAG-AFTRA.
Okay. Well, good for Heidi Swedberg.
Yeah. I'm not worried for her.
I mean, she can afford to be a professional ukulele player, so she's probably doing okay.
Exactly.
This episode originally aired October 28th, 1992. And this did decently. I think I got 16 million viewers, and that's like about okay for the season. But season four is the last season when it was just kind of doing okay because it was airing in the 9:30 time slot after Cheers. Cheers ended in June and Seinfeld got its slot. And the next season, it went from like the 25th most watched show above Blossom and below Dr. Quinn to the third most watched show behind Home Improvement and ahead of Roseanne. So it went from like...
Behind Home Improvement.
Home Improvement was the number one. 60 Minutes is the number one show. Home Improvement is the number one.
How 90s
sitcom.
Is that? Three stand-up comedians anchoring their shows. That's just how they made sitcoms back then.
Yeah, I think Grace Under Fire is pretty high up there too at that point.
I forgot about her. We all forgot about her.
That's not true.
There's a Grace Under Fire we have in our back pocket that we're going to do one day.
Nice.
So yeah, it was getting like 25 million viewers an episode, which is insane to think about now. The Cheever Letters was directed by Tom Sharonis, who is most famous for directing a bunch of Seinfeld episodes. He directed 81 of them. The story is by Larry David, Tom Leopold, and Elaine Pope. Elaine Pope started out as a writer for Fridays, which was ABC's answer to Saturday Night Live, and is where Michael Richards got his start.
Yep.
So they would have known each other for a long time. Tom Leopold started out in a comedy group with Christopher Guest, Michael McKean, Martin Mull, Rob Reiner, and Harry Shearer. And then Larry David, teleplay by Larry David, as this in the previous Seinfeld episode. I saw Larry David in a public restroom once, and it was as awkward as you can imagine.
Was it like a multiple person public restroom?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Strange man. And now the episode. The previous episode literally ends with Jerry, Elaine, George, Kramer, Susan, and a woman with an annoying laugh that Jerry briefly dates, standing there watching in horror as the cabin burns to the ground. And I think it's like a few days later at the least, and Jerry and George are in Jerry's apartment, and Susan has still not told her parents, and she wants George to be there when she tells her parents that the family cabin is gone.
It's also the first time George is meeting the parents.
Terrible idea. Jerry has this weird sense of humor about it.
Well, you'll make quite an impression on him when you tell him how you burned his cabin down.
I didn't burn it down. Kramer did.
I mean, the whole thing is ironic. Think of it. Here the guy is nice enough to give you a box of very fine Cuban cigars.
Yeah, I know what happened.
No, but wait. And then you dump them off onto Kramer.
I know.
Who proceeds to burn the man's cabin down with one of those very same cigars. It's very comical.
It is. And that comes up again and again in this episode. Maybe this is how Seinfeld works in general, but I took a class in college and we had to analyze an episode of Seinfeld to write a paper about it. And
what class was this?
Writing 109 VA, writing for visual arts. And one of the things we had to do was talk about plot structure in a sitcom. Maybe more so than other sitcoms, Seinfeld tends to have a balanced structure where a lot of scenes repeat and there's like a lot of parallelism and then a lot of like symbolic like things. What do you call it? It's balanced. Like something happens on one end, the opposite thing happens on another end. And there's like a nice art to the architecture of a Seinfeld episode that a lot of other sitcom episodes, I don't think does, but maybe I'm just haven't noticed.
You've never watched a little show called Small Wonder.
I have actually. Please, at some point, you might be able to tell us all about Small Wonder.
I will.
Okay.
They're also great at weaving their A lines, B lines there. Really? It all converges at the end.
Really well. So the last episode we did was a Simpsons episode where it just does not come together. It's like really clunky and forced. Like this, actually, the gay element just doesn't really have a real place in there. There's a lot
going
on.
Which episode?
The one where Homer moves in with two gay guys.
Oh, yeah. A year after him being a homophobe and he becomes a straggart.
Like 5 years after.
Time means nothing with The Simpsons.
Yeah. It truly doesn't. So yeah, time-wise, we don't know how much it was. But yeah, this does a really good job. And one of the things is the fact that the kind of irony that Jerry's talking about, where you try to do something nice and ends up biting you in the ass, comes up several times in this episode.
I also love the fact that they couldn't think of anything to put in a script. And they have this thing that actually is funny that happened in real life and it doesn't even occur to them. Maybe this could be the pilot.
That was okay. So I've never written a script. Okay. And I certainly have never written something collaboratively. How accurate is their procrastination?
Very.
Oh my God, yes.
Bix? What'd you get, Bix?
Well, you got a problem with the pen now.
They're like a rolling writer. They're very smooth.
All right, let's just get to work.
NBC pilot, Seinfeld Project, Act One, Scene A.
So you're gonna sit there?
Let me explain to you one of the key elements involved in the writing process. Because it may seem outwardly that the pen and the paper and the chair play a large role, but they're all somewhat incidental to the actual using of the brain. Okay, so just park yourself.
My favorite is David Cross. He wrote a book that wasn't very funny, but he talked about the writing process. He had a list of things to procrastinate. My favorite was spending 3.5 hours to find the perfect 20-second clip to masturbate to.
That doesn't usually happen when you have a co-writer, but yeah, masturbation is a huge part
it's a
of
good distraction.
The writing process. Yeah.
It also seems like a metaphor, probably. So I literally don't understand how you could write collaboratively with someone. It seems like such a disjointed, like, it seems like it would be so hard, but I'm just bad at cooperating.
Well, it depends on the person.
Do you know how, like, when I write, like, I stare or talk to myself or pace? Like, it's like that, but, like, when I say something, someone else responds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't often do it, but, like, there is something to having someone fill the dead air, the dead space when you're trying to think of something and just having the thoughts keep coming. Eventually it's like climbing out of a dirt hole as it's raining. Like if you just cling to the sides of the wall, like right. You just start slipping down. But if you just keep climbing, even though it doesn't seem like you're getting anywhere, that's what co-writing is.
Okay.
You get it.
Somebody gave me a hand up.
Yeah.
Sounds like a nightmare.
But like there's a lot of eating. There's a lot of talking about so-and-so. There's sometimes you...
The riffing helps.
Yeah.
It's fucking around. You're like, oh, that was good. Let's...
It's the reason why like TV has this writer's rooms because they don't have the luxury of film writing where like you can take the time to come up with your own solution. Like you just say things and eventually something will stick because it has to because you have a schedule and you have to shoot it.
Okay. It also helps too if you just outline together and then divide. It's like, okay, you do this scene, I'll do this scene and let's reconverge and see what works.
Yeah, not everyone is built for co-writing.
Right. I assume that I am not and that's why I haven't and I don't want to. I do relate to the procrastination aspect and I like how they're like, weren't you supposed to call Elaine? And they immediately, he's like, oh yeah, I got to call Elaine. A result of this phone call is that Jerry says to Elaine, like, can you please not make me have to talk to your assistant for like 20 minutes before I get to talk to you? And she immediately tells Sandra.
Could you do me a favor? When my friends call, could you not talk to them for too long?
Why, did Jerry say something?
No.
He must have said something.
Oh, no, he didn't say anything.
I can't work for you.
Oh, God.
I can't. I'm leaving.
No, Sandra, I'm sorry. I really am. Listen. Jerry's under a lot of pressure right now. It's very hard being a stand-up comedian. Sometimes they don't laugh.
She's a neurotic mess because Elaine telling her not to talk to her friends for like an undue amount of time, like completely makes her melt down and she runs away. And this actress has not really done much. Her name is Lisa Malkowitz. She's the exception to the role. The woman with the annoying laugh ended up being, from the previous episode, ends up being one of the two leads from Hope and Gloria. Lisa Malkowitz didn't really do that much after this, but she seems very perfect for the Seinfeld universe about being an interesting, pretty woman who just cannot cope with regular life and explodes for no reason, basically.
I mean, yeah, the Seinfeld girlfriends often have like a very specific quirk.
A comedic flaw.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to think of the luxury of being able to talk back to your boss. Like if your boss says to you, oh, can you not have casual conversations with my friends when they call?
Mm-hmm.
And then having some sort of reaction other than like, I'm sorry, it won't happen again.
It is weird that happens. And I think it is part of the parallelism that I was talking about where her storyline kind of parallels Susan's dad as being someone who takes bad news extremely poorly And also,
well, no, his bad news his bed is
far
actually,
worse.
But
and also, like, a bad thing that happened to him, like, she brought this on herself.
But
I think it's more a comment on the economy of the 90s, the booming Clinton economy.
That she can afford to just quit on a whim and probably get a job somewhere else. So they're not the same, but like, there are a few ways in which the Sandra woman, her storyline mirrors what happens with Susan's dad in small ways.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, I'd say like the main
there's a
like,
parallel.
The main parallel is
the meltdown,
is the sexy talk, which we'll get to.
Right, which is very strange. So when she storms out, Elaine tries to reason with her and like get her to come back. One of the things she says is, "He's a comedian. Sometimes they don't laugh." What is that? Is she saying that it's hard to be a comedian because sometimes the audience they're performing to doesn't laugh,
yes.
Or is he saying that like? Sometimes a comedian is not a happy, comical person. Sometimes they're sad and they're like me.
It's the first one.
It's the first one.
Yeah, it's a throwaway joke.
Yeah. Okay. Like, it's one of those things that wouldn't be funny except Julie Louis-Dreyfus was able to sell the joke.
She's very good at that.
And I just love the weirdness she had of Elaine having an underling and not being able to like be a boss about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's that innate, she's such a woman child. That the idea of like, I'm your boss, but I still don't know how to handle you.
And also she wants her back, apparently, because she asked Jerry to undo the damage. Maybe she just feels bad, but like, yeah, it's weird that she feels indebted to this like bad assistant.
But not the first time we've seen that. Anytime she is a supervisor of somebody, she cannot handle it.
Like the Susie episode.
Like the Susie episode.
It does not go well.
Or anything with the whole Peterman being a CEO.
That's sort
thing.
Of like the Elaine of it all in this show. Like, yeah, Jerry's a successful comedian. Kramer and George are their own sort of fuck-ups. And, like, Elaine tries to carry herself like she's a professional woman. But she's a deeply flawed character in her own right and can't make her life work because of many of the things that she does.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And she seems like she'd like to think she's better than the other three, but she's very much so not.
Oh, no.
That ends. We go back to Jerry's apartment and Kramer enters. And they're still doing the applause thing when he enters because they didn't realize that was annoying.
Did they stop that?
They eventually stopped doing that, I think, because it's distracting or like it slows down the episode or whatever. Kramer's whole storyline, I don't enjoy.
What's with you?
No more golf.
Why?
Well, you remember I told you about the pro, you know, at the Westchester Country Club who's letting me play around every time I gave him a couple of those Cuban cigars?
Yeah?
Yeah, well, I lost them all in that fire.
Hey, George, maybe you can ask Susan's father for some more, huh?
Crazy? I can't ask the guy for more cigars after you burned down his cabin.
Why? What's one thing got to do with another?
When he says the, I don't see how the two are connected, how aware do you think he actually is? Because there is the knee jerk of maybe he just doesn't see it, or maybe he is smarter than he lets on, and he is just playing that affect. It's the first time it actually occurred to me when I watched it last night. I was like, maybe he does know, and he's just manipulating George. It's the first time it ever occurred to me.
I don't think he has, like, I don't think he cares enough to either know or not know.
Mm-hmm. Kramer is a weird one in that he's not even in this episode too much, and when it's his golf plotline, I'm like, I don't really care. And I feel like...
With the Cubans?
Yeah, it's just...
The embassy.
It ties in the least with everything. And I feel like someone once described Newman as being a pungent spice that you have to use very sparingly because if mm-hmm. you use too much, it spoils the entire dish. I feel like Kramer is that way also, that Kramer should come in and do flavor and then get the hell out of there. And when they spend too much time on him, I get annoyed with him because he's such a frustrating weirdo, but...
Sometimes his storylines, they don't often relate to anything that anyone else is doing, but they're so unique that you forgive them. This just happens to be one that's not very engaging
right.
anyway, or even memorable. It's like, oh, he wants cigars. He can't get them because the source for the cigars. And so he goes to, I mean, spoiler, because we probably won't talk about it much. Like, he goes to a Cuban embassy, makes friends with Cubans, and then that's pretty much it.
He was such a fan favorite in the 90s, though. Like, I mean, it was a zeitgeist of Kramer.
He was zany. And yeah, I don't really get it now. George leaves the writing scene to go because he's going to meet with the Rosses and he leaves 4 hours early because he doesn't want to write.
With zero writing done.
No writing. And then we meet the Rosses and the Rosses are amazing.
Perfect.
Oh my gosh. This is the first time we ever see them and they seem like they're so well situated in the Seinfeld universe. They're the exactly kind of like broken, like weirdo parents. They like make sense of, like contrasted to all the other parents we've met.
Mm-hmm.
Every line of dialogue between her father and her mother is exactly what that line of dialogue should be.
Yes. It's really good. The father is Warren Frost, who plays Doc Haywood on Twin Peaks, is Laura Flynn Boyle's dad on Twin Peaks. And on that show, he's like a very calm, loving, nurturing person who like has delivered most of the children in Twin Peaks. He's not playing that. He's a cantankerous, crusty, angry, red-faced, mean person who seems to hate everybody. We find out why. And then Mrs. Ross is played by Grace Zabriskie, who plays Laura Palmer's mom on Twin Peaks. And on there, they're an alcoholic in both versions, but she's like such a psychic mess in Twin Peaks. She's just like the receptacle for like so much horrible things. And in this one, she's delightful. She's tipsy the entire meal. Everything's funny to her. Nothing seems to bother her. And I love her every reaction to things. She's just so happy to be drunk.
And less cruel than we see her like a couple of years later.
The evolution of their marriage is very interesting. I want to talk about at the end of the episode how they don't split up after this episode. They stay together.
I assume for the money.
I assume they stay together out of a shared mutual hatred for George Costanza. They find someone that they hate more than each other. They want to hate George together.
I could see that.
That's basically all they ever do for the rest of the existence of the show is hate George.
That is like their mission. They set up a foundation just to ruin this person's life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, their marriage is also sort of reminiscent of the titular author in this episode, who was married to a woman that... There was no love between them, really, according to his daughter.
Well, not a happy marriage. I think we might have read the same article.
It's called Wikipedia.
Oh, mine was an article in The Guardian, and it did not sound nice. But yeah, I think Susan's dad is very much supposed to be a John Cheever stand-in, which... Oh, there's another Twin Peaks connection. Warren Frost's son is Mark Frost, who's the co-creator of Twin Peaks. And the episode that the Rosses come back on with the marble rye, the woman that Jerry mugs to get the marble rye is from Twin Peaks. She plays the creepy old woman that's on Laura's Meals on Wheels route,
mm-hmm.
who has like a haunted like grandson who's a magician.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's just a lot of weird Twin Peaksiness centered right here.
Meta.
Mm-hmm. I like that the first line is...
Doesn't George look like your sister, Sarah?
A slight resemblance.
Which isn't the first time we've had a doppelganger on that show. Remember, he dates the doppelganger of Jerry.
Which is very Twin Peaks, according to Drew.
There's a lot of doppelgangers on Twin Peaks. And there is another episode where George is worried that he's getting tits. And he's on a
bosomy.
He's on the subway, and there's a woman to be like, "We're twins," and he's like, "What?" And she has like giant boobs, but she's just referring to the fact that they happen to be dressed similarly.
Yeah,
and he's very offended by this. There's a lot of queering of George throughout the entire show. There's a lot of
when the kids call him a Mary. This is the first time I ever heard the term Mary. I didn't know that was a gay slur.
When did they call him Mary?
There was something. Oh, it's an earlier episode. He jumped across a puddle and a bunch of... It might have been the same episode where his dick moves when the male masseuse is massaging him.
Right.
And now he's afraid he's gay. And a bunch of kids, apparently this is a story he's retelling, is like they called him a Mary because I had to be explained why he was being called a Mary.
Right.
Kids can be very perceptive.
Is that what they say in the
episode? That's what they say. That's
true.
Response.
Are we going to do the male masseuse episode?
We should. I mean, we're making our way through the queering of George Costanza, which is essentially, if you do the gay episodes of Seinfeld, that's what it is. And there's a lot of queering of him in this too, where he makes it like the dad's like, "How do you like the cigars?" He's like, "Oh, I'm sucking them down." So he gets told that he looks like this like paraplegic aunt, number one. And number two, he's just sucking them down left and right.
And also, he does an impression of Johnny Carson.
Oh, the cigars. I'm sucking them down. I'm puffing my brains out, yeah.
You know those cigars are made special for Castro? Oh,
I did not know that. Weird. Wild.
What?
He's doing Johnny Carson, Daddy.
I didn't care much for his jokes.
Daddy never laughs.
Oh, well, so what? Laughter. What is that? I mean, what is the point of opening your mouth and going, ha ha? What is that?
And I just feel like a lot of queer youth often did a lot of impressions because we weren't allowed to have personalities of our own.
Don't forget Elaine's line when she's talking about somebody being a handsome man. And isn't he beautiful or something like that? And George is like, I don't know. And she says to him, just because a man can admit that another man is beautiful doesn't make him gay. To which it doesn't help.
Like they love
queering.
They love selling George out as being gay, even though it's Probably not, but yeah.
We don't want them.
That's so the 90s, no. though. You were allowed to make fun of somebody being gay mm-hmm. if they were either a closet case or not actually gay. Mm-hmm. It was that weird in-between of like, it's not homophobic because we're for it. And
right.
that like in-between places.
Most
we're talking about it. It's yeah. not terrible.
A ton of humor on The Simpsons in the 90s is like implying that someone's gay as a joke.
But. Yeah.
So he does the Johnny Carson impression, and the dad's response is, I didn't think that was funny. And Susan says, Daddy doesn't laugh. And that's another word callback to like what Elaine yells at Sandra. It's like, sometimes they just don't laugh. And I'm like, okay, so there's a parallel there. And then he starts talking about the cigars more, and the wife is like,
you know, you can't get those cigars anywhere.
You and your cigars.
Where's some more lipstick?
And like, if we're talking about Freudian metaphors, mm-hmm. a guy obsessed with cigars, there's just a lot of stuff here. And I like his response to her is like, put on some more lipstick.
Yeah. <that's->
Which is something a catty gay man would say to a woman that he's not a.
But it also like, that is such an old white man thing to say to his wife. Like mm-hmm.
these wasps.
Like they really have nothing to talk about. Other than just like criticizing each other.
I right. like how they're proto Will and Grace. You got this queen and the redhead he lives with.
If Will couldn't come out and ended up marrying Grace and they became miserable alcoholics.
Thing, yeah. Again.
Yeah. So like that's all happening. And it's getting to the point where they're trying to talk to the dad about the cabin, but it's not working. And
George is useless at that too.
Susan also is too, because she keeps passing it off to him. They keep passing it off to each other.
I can understand why she wouldn't want to.
It's her dad. But yeah, but she's kind of selling out George because that's a terrible way to meet parents, but what?
And he has no tact about it, too.
No.
Burned him.
But then parallel to this is the conversation that's happening the same time at Jerry's apartment between Elaine and Jerry, where he's like, of course she thought that I was the one who complained about it because you had this conversation right after she took my call. And she's like, can you please like have this conversation you don't want to have and like give her, like talk to this person. It's not really his fault. It's something Elaine should take care of, but he steps in and improvs apology or like an explanation for how he didn't actually want to insult her.
Hello, Sandra. Hi, this is Jerry Seinfeld. Listen, I just want to tell you, there's been a terrible misunderstanding. See, I told Elaine that it was a real treat talking to you on the phone. And she thought I was being sarcastic, you know, because I'm a comedian and all. She thought I think, yeah, it's a real treat talking to her on the phone. Yeah. But I was really being sincere. No, of course I like you. Tonight? Hold on a second. Now she wants to have a drink with me. Oh, I know. Yeah, I think I can. Yeah, I know where that is. Okay, I'll see you there. Okay, bye. Now I gotta have a drink with her.
Well, it was his fault. I mean, it directly came from him saying this.
No, it's Elaine's fault. Elaine should have known not to do it immediately afterwards.
Yeah. She knows nothing.
Fucking book.
If we learned anything in this series.
No, she knows lots. She should not have done it.
Yeah. So then we go back to the Rosses, and he's talking about every reason that he loves the cabin.
About the cab.
I love that place. My father built that cabin in 1947. My mother was recuperating from impetigo at the time, and Dad thought it would be a good idea to get her out into the fresh air. She died there the following winter. Dad passed away 10 years later to the day. His last words to me were, "Cherish the cabin." Not take care of your sister. She's a paraplegic. But cherish the cabin. And I have for 45 years. It's often been a sanctuary for me.
Grandma Ross did have it really bad because she died shortly after they built the cabin.
But they didn't say she died of the impetigo.
But she was recovering from a disease and then she died there. And then the grandpa dies and his last words are cherish the cabin, not take care of the sister who's a paraplegic. And then the mom's like,
Daddy?
Yes?
Daddy, about the cabin.
Look, Henry, I spilled wine on me.
Her delivery is so good. It's so good to see this woman smile and be happy. And then
she's not happy. Like, you keep describing her as happy. She's drunk because she's deeply unhappy. Like, the only way she doesn't see her prison is
she's
just like,
giddy. I'll give her. She's, you know, drunk, giddy.
She's smiling. And it's weird to see Grace Zabriskie smile. She doesn't usually get a chance to do that at all, even if it's for drunk reasons.
But it's an affected smile.
Oh, yeah, she's hammered.
I'm just horrified. Do you think this woman's actually happy when she's deeply miserable?
I don't think she's actually happy. I'm happy to see Grace Zabriskie smile.
Okay.
I mean, there you she go. Stopped smiling very shortly, but...
She laughs about the cabin burning down.
She
finds joy in that.
She finds much joy in that.
Vindictive joy in that.
Well, the thing is...
What? What is it?
Well, the cabin is kind of... George?
Burned. Burned?
There was a fire, and it,
burned. The cabin burned? Burned. Was anything found? Was it all burned to the ground? Did they find anything?
No, nothing.
Nothing?
Mr. Ross just leaves. He doesn't even respond, right? He just leaves the room.
I believe so.
Yeah, well, I remember Susan going, Daddy!
And then it cuts to later that night at Jerry's apartment where the date with Sandra's already happened. And she is also leaving in a huff because he said something to her. And we don't know what it is initially, but she's like horrified and offended.
I can't believe you said that!
What?
How could you say something like that to me?
What? You were the one who was talking dirty. I was just trying to keep up.
Weird thing to say.
Why? It didn't mean anything. I was just trying to join in so you wouldn't feel embarrassed.
Oh, I think you're really sick.
I'm not sick. You said much sicker things than me.
I'm leaving.
I really think you're making too much of this.
Excuse me.
I mean, let me walk you to a cab.
That's okay.
I mean, really, the main thing is that this is just between us, and that'll be the end of it.
Oh, really?
I mean, people, they're not interested in things like this. They don't want to hear about it. They really don't.
This actually is something that gives me a lot of anxiety because I'm very bad at dirty talk. And if anyone wants to do that, I'm like, I don't know what to say. And I'm worried I will say something stupid like what Jerry says, where I say something that's like borderline horrifying. I don't know. I'm not an improv person, and it's...
Oh, no, I'm great at dirty talk. I'm fantastic at it. I just got the impulses for it.
It's so confusing to me. It's like when someone tries to talk to me at the gym, I'm like, I have gym brain. Like, my brain's not really good at making words right now. It's like the exact same thing. It takes so much for me to concentrate on like a physical activity that I can't make words. Please don't try to challenge me to do that.
I'm just picturing you yelling, shut up at someone's dick.
Yeah. That's a good summary.
Or like Miranda in Sex and the City where she just yells at the butthole because she doesn't want to write. I don't want to do that.
She really yells at a butthole?
Yes, she does. There's a whole episode about a guy loves getting rimmed. And so the shot is you see her and you just see his ass in the shot. And she keeps moving her head and the ass just keeps moving to it. And she just screams at it. I don't want to do that. It's very neurotic.
It was
moment.
A nice butt.
It was a great butt. Yeah. I would elect it.
Yeah, I expect nothing less of whoever casts butts on Sex and the City.
Of course.
Glenn, do you have a reach around for the dirty talk?
Yeah.
Explosion?
I mean, it relates because it's words that for some reason society decides that we shouldn't say or should be embarrassed about. And so get bottled up or not talked about. We're not allowed to talk about them. And so Susan's father, for however many years, wasn't able to say the things he wished he could have said. And so it's just weird that like, in Susan's father's case, it was love, not sex. But in Seinfeld's case, it's the weird thing he says.
Right.
And which we just arbitrarily decide, or someone decides, is not worth hearing.
I mean, we get to it shortly, and it is a weird thing to say. But yeah, I guess everyone, like, she reacts with horror, and the Rosses react to horror to the revelation about their father and something that got bottled up.
I mean, it's all, but like so many sitcoms in the 90s and 80s and before, it's like, what struck me most about this episode is just how quaint the discussion of sex and dirty talk is. Like, how sex is dealt with now on TV is so much different. And seeing George's reaction to Jerry describing what she says, which we can't hear, but George squeezing the ketchup bottle and the ketchup flying out of it like an orgasm.
So, yeah, that's the next scene. And I was not expecting – I didn't remember that there was like basically a cum joke essentially, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did not remember that at all. But that is the next scene. They take an ad break right after the scene where Sandra stomps out of the room. We should do that too.
Okay.
Hey, Glenn. Do you want to hear about the new online friends we made this week?
You're going to tell me anyway, so let's say yes.
That's a bad attitude, but it looks like my heartfelt plea for validation, specifically in the form of iTunes reviews, paid off because some very nice people reached out and said, hey, you guys don't suck. Isn't that nice?
If you're conditioned to believe compliments.
Okay, well, I'm going to read two of those right now. The first comes from Riley O, and this person says, as a lesbian, I was a little skeptical that this series would hook me, but I was totally wrong! Exclamation point. I will listen to these two discuss anything. They are thoughtful, witty, and display an impossibly encyclopedic knowledge of TV history. Every episode is funny, many are unexpectedly touching, and I always learn something new. Love you guys. P.S. Glenn, share your thoughts on Sailor Moon someday soon. Which you'll do one day, right?
One day soon.
Okay. And then Rob St. Clair, which is a name you're going to hear twice in this little ad segment, says, Drew and Glenn are the perfect combination of entertainment, pop culture knowledge, and snark. That makes this podcast extremely entertaining and re-listenable, which I don't think we've ever been described with that adjective before. I love revisiting old favorites with a contemporary eye. 10 out of 10, continually recommend to friends. Now, if Glenn can find a reach around for Alf, maybe the Christmas episode where he pretends to be a stuffed animal somehow correlating to pretending to be something you're not to be accepted. I don't know. Love you guys.
I would probably talk about the episode where he lives with a blind woman.
That's actually a good idea. And I think everyone who listens to the show has been itching for some Alf content ever since we started.
You mean ever since I drew that Alf wearing a gay rights shirt?
It's great. It's a great piece of art. I really like it. Thank you to Riley and Rob. And if you want to hear me, or if you like Glenn, read your review in a future episode, all you have to do is give us 5 stars and share your thoughts about why Gayest Episode Ever is your favorite podcast that has two gay guys discussing gay-centric installments of classic sitcoms. There might be another one somewhere. I don't really know.
I'm not looking. Hey, Drew, there was a note stabbed into my door with a bread knife that said, ask about Patreon.
So glad you asked me, Glenn, in what is an organic, normal conversation that we have once a week, and during which, if we have a guest, they remain silent and unmentioned without any explanation. I'm happy to report that horny art does well for us. Thank you very much, Mike Brady. We actually have 5 new patrons to thank, as anyone who donated at the $3 a month level or higher gets an on-air expression of gratitude and a compliment from the box of compliments. Glenn, if you are ready.
Always.
Jennifer Roshek, who upped her monthly donation from $1 to $3. Thank you, Jennifer.
I hope that means something good is going on in her life. She is thoughtful and caring. Like Mrs. Garrett. Is it Mrs. Garrett? Did her husband die?
We should probably know that, but I don't know that.
Okay. I think it's Ms. Garrett.
John M. Mysterious.
This is just a drawing of a sheep that says ba. But I guess that means he is sweet or soft and helps people go to sleep.
That might be the last of the confusing compliments. I think we're... It's not that bad, really.
I mean, I like sheep.
It's a good drawing of a sheep, though, right?
No.
Oh. Drew, like me, last name Waranis.
Sweet and harmonious, like the friendship between B. Arthur and Rue McClanahan.
Not like acrid and disharmonious, like the relationship between B. Arthur and Betty White. Rob St. Clair, who upped his donation from $5 to $10, which means he got to see your horny art.
Ooh. It turns out they're the real boss, not Tony. Not Angela, not Mona. Surprise. Was that the series finale of Who's the Boss?
I don't actually remember how that show ended. Do you?
I remember the last season. I don't remember how it ended.
Hmm. There's a joke in Community, I think, about, I think Abed proves scientifically who the boss was, and that scientifically the answer is Angela.
Yeah, because she wrote the paychecks.
Yeah, but he proves it. I saw that episode a long time ago.
Next.
Costa, no last name.
Well, the box of compliments is empty, so I'm just going to read the first thing I see in this office. Sensational, like the She-Hulk.
Not bad.
Yeah, that worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I knew there's a reason She-Hulk goes out here. Glenn, if someone listening wants their own compliment from the box of compliments, or one that Glenn makes up on the spot on his own, in what manner should they comport themselves?
Go to patreon.com/gayestepisodeever or click the link in the show notes. You can pledge as little as $1 a month or do $3 a month or higher to get an on-air thank you.
Glenn, by the way, what are your thoughts on Sailor Moon?
Please don't tempt me.
We want to know.
Yeah, well, then you'll tune in later.
And we're back. So there's a cum joke that I did not remember.
Squirt.
It is sort of homoerotic that essentially, like, the metaphor here is that Jerry is getting George off by telling him a story about panties, more or less. Like, the filthiest thing about this story is panties. And it is sort of weird. It was like, I guess it was not, like, forbidden to talk about, say the word panties as many times.
Well, it's the linguistics of panties. Think about it.
George
panties,
is getting off.
Penis, pussy. Something about that popping pee is always kind of erotic.
George gets off. We don't know what gets him off because the woman was saying we don't hear. So it's not what Jerry says that gets George off.
So then we go back to my apartment.
Whoa.
So we're fooling around there, you know, just getting a little passionate. And she starts with the dirty talking.
All right, hold on. Time out. Whoa.
What did she say? The usual.
No, I don't know. How do I know the usual?
Typical things.
What's typical? Give me typical. Give me some typical.
She says, I don't know.
And then he explains about the stupid thing he responds to.
Not the first time they had dirty talk, too. Remember when Elaine gets the tape recorder? I think that's like season 2.
Oh,
and they're all
yeah.
like fixated about like whatever she was saying on that too, which we never hear, but they're all like infatuated with it.
That is an interesting point because at the end of the episode, the stand-up that Jerry's doing is about leaving obscene voicemails. Mm-hmm. Like how like sex talk is going to turn into like sexy voicemails. And that is essentially what he's dealing with in that episode with Elaine leaving like a sexy voice memo on his recorder.
And then everyone wants to fuck her.
Everybody in 90s Manhattan is infatuated with Elaine Bennis for some reason.
I mean, she's gorgeous.
She's adorable.
In a 90s kind of way.
Except for that dress she wears later in this episode, which is hideous, but...
She had a lot of fashion nose in those early years.
They did not do her a lot of solids. And then they fixed her hair too, and that took away from the character, but also made her more standardly sexier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mid-90s hot.
What do you make of the thing that Jerry says that was so revulsive to Sandra?
That's absolutely filthy.
And then she starts talking about her panties.
I'm going to need some water here.
So I said something.
Okay, what did you say?
Now, bear in mind, I am just trying to keep up.
Of course.
Okay? So she's talking about her panties. So I said, you mean the panties your mother laid out for you?
The panties your mother laid out for you? What does that mean?
I don't know. Just popped out.
Well, how did she react?
She flipped out. Just left.
Well, that's not offensive. It's abnormal, but it's not offensive.
Don't bring up somebody's mother. I feel that's whatever the girl version of a boner killer is.
That's okay.
It does sort of imply that like her mom is somehow involved in like pimping her out in some way. Like it feels very sort of old worldy, like you're going to go on a date with your father's friend from work.
Oh, God. This is your dowry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, there's an infantilism kind of thing, too. Like, is it a little girl's panties? And
panties is a very infantilized word, and that a lot of women object to it for that reason. It is weird that we call it that. It's like a cutesy little kid word for underwear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's worth walking out of the bedroom for, though, her reaction scene.
But she freaked out we've seen her freak out once.
She has a flair for the dramatic. She's very easy to rattle, and she just kind of explodes when something does not go her way. That's as much as we know about her.
So what? She's probably triggered by her mother.
Probably.
What area of dirty talk would make you leave the bedroom?
Anything scat involved.
Yeah.
That'll shut it down.
Probably a lot of things will make me sound very square, but like there's a lot of things I don't want to talk about. What about you, Glenn?
Oh, someone started trash talking the original English dub of Sailor Moon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, back during like the 90s where they used a lot of Clueless slang.
Yeah.
She said Shaw as if a lot in that first dub.
Did she really?
Oh my God, I loved it for that. Yeah. Because it was right around the same time that Clueless was out. So when they were recording that English dub, they used a lot of that slang.
They made some choices, but I love them for it.
Oh my God, same.
So don't say that to Glenn in the bedroom. Yeah. Anything else you want to add to this list of like non-sexy sex talk?
Oh, what else?
I mean, I think you nailed it pretty well with scat, but I don't know how you can outdo scat.
About sticking something in my pee hole. Ow.
Yeah. I don't want to think about that.
That's, right? Yeah. Like, that's just, we're done. Turn it off.
Some people do that. And that's more power to them.
I had somebody that made a reference to Bill Cosby in bed to this day. No Cosby in bed. And this is before he was arrested.
This is not on my list. Oh. You can talk about pudding pops.
Oh.
No? Okay.
That's no.
No, because that reminds me of scat now.
Yeah.
That's Cosby and scat. Nope.
You doubled down on it, Glenn.
And you got the popsicle stick. Now I'm thinking it's sounding. You got the trifecta of my boner death in bed.
I don't want to think about scat anymore.
Now a word from our sponsors, scat.
Okay, so Jerry doesn't seem to understand the similarity of the situation. Just earlier, he was noting how it was funny that Susan's dad gave these cigars that ended up burning down his cabin. But it is kind of a parallel situation where he tried to help Elaine out by doing this nice thing and apologizing to Sandra. And it ended up with him saying something he very much so regrets. And now he's worried that it's going to get back to Elaine. He's going to be embarrassed for it. He doesn't seem to understand it's a very similar situation. It's another weird parallelism where it's not quite on the same level, but like you tried to do something nice and ended up biting you in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, Sandra has returned to Pendant Publishing and now he's worried that Elaine's going to find out. Is there anything else in this scene?
Is that the name of Elaine's company?
Pendant. That.
Oh, I thought you said Pendant Publishing. I was like, oh, that's a little on the nose.
Yeah. At this point, that's where she's working for. And then I think next season she's working for Mr. Pitt.
Mr. Pitt for an entire season. That job just made me sad.
Yeah.
It's just their nadir of her career.
Wow.
At least Peterman, he was fun.
And she got to be technically in charge of the company for a while, even though she
ran into the ground.
Yeah. George says that like Mr. Ross didn't take the news well. And he like does a motion, like a hand going over his head, as if the humor just went right over Mr. Ross's head. So they think that. And he does actually try when Jerry suggests that this is actually secretly funny on some level, he rejects it. And then when he's desperate to try to appease Mr. Ross, he tries it again. And it's not a good idea. Do you guys notice that the cashier is not Ruthie Cohen in the background?
I was looking at that.
It's some other
woman. I thought she just had different hair or something. So it's a different woman.
She's not listed in the credits. So do you know Ruthie Cohen?
She's in almost every episode.
She is the most recurring character on Seinfeld. She's the cashier at Monk's Diner. And I don't think she ever talks, except for there's one time where she tells George, your car's on fire. In the episode where he thinks that she's like shortchanged him money. Sometimes she's not there. I don't know where she is. But other than that, she's almost always there. And yeah, no Ruthie Cohen.
Remember when the Lego convention tried to shortchange me?
I do remember that. We went to a Lego convention on Saturday and they tried to stiff him on some money and we fixed it.
I fixed it.
Yeah.
That's the end of the story.
Yeah.
And then sidebar, they had adorable little custom Lego guys at Long Beach Comic Con.
You gotta be careful of those.
Why? Are they gonna attack me at night? Are they gonna come?
Well, they pretend. Sometimes they sell figures as if they're the real Lego, but it's very easy to get the
Chinese. Oh, they're flat out. They told me they were customs.
Okay.
But they're all Dragon Ball Z, so I was
going to
get my Android 17, sure.
Caution, is that the one female character?
That 18, she's 18. By far my favorite.
Yeah, she's the best.
Did you guys watch Dragon Ball Super?
No, I never.
I've seen
the best concept. There's no plot because they always suck at that. Just put a bunch of people, Royal Rumble, and whoever survives doesn't get their universe erased. Everyone else dies. Oh my God, stakes, loved it.
There was like a group that was like a Sailor Moon spoof, but they were fat.
They morph through these fat women. They're super powerful. It's great.
Dragon Ball Z has been something that's always been hard for me to want to get into because my perception of it is that there are so very few female characters.
Oh my God. It's because Akira Toriyama doesn't like romance, A. So it's a hard time fitting these girls in there.
Also, his drawing style doesn't necessarily lend itself to a lot of female variation.
Yeah.
I mean, the ones he did for Chrono Trigger look great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm, okay. The three female characters he had to put there.
So we're just going to skip over the Cuban embassy plotline.
The C story, sure.
So Elaine comes back in and she's wearing like a doily, a giant doily over like a peach dress. And I'm just like, I don't normally have this reaction. I'm like, what the fuck did they do to you, Julie Louis Dreyfus? You're a very pretty woman. You cannot tell under that. And George is like, oh, I have Susan's sunglasses. I have to drop them off. And Jerry's like, oh, does she live with her parents? And he's like, no. And then they don't pick it up again. It's a very weird aside because all they need to do is establish that George has to go to the Rosses for some reason just to like send them there. And like the sunglasses don't matter. And there's no reason for Jerry to ask that question.
Was George living with his parents at this point?
I don't know.
I think so.
Okay.
I just assumed it was a reference to that. Oh. Like he was just digging in.
Okay. That makes sense.
Does she live with his parents?
Like you're you're both losers.
I guess only you're a loser, George.
So
it's true.
They're all losers.
They're George all is losers.
The worst loser. So then they immediately go to the Ross's apartment again.
I thought it would be nicer.
The dining room seemed like it was nicer, yeah. And then the living room's kind of blah. So that didn't really match.
Especially when the door opens into the living room, like that's not
there should have been an entryway.
People apartment. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought they were old money. And
I thought they had
like
a whole townhouse.
I thought they had like a pre-war.
I think they probably do because they have enough money to start the Susan Biddle Ross Foundation after she dies.
Right,
because
they list off all the assets they were supposed to have, but they have a living room that has the front entrance right there.
I mean, when they return later in the series, they appear to be richer.
Right.
Right. So maybe that's just the set they had. And also, in addition to not being as rich as we would like them to be, they're even more miserable Ross relatives. We see Aunt Sarah.
This is my Aunt Sarah.
He doesn't look like me.
She kind of does.
She does kind
like
of look
a little
like,
bit. And then we see Ricky Ross, who is Susan's little brother, never to be seen again.
Also, what is the age difference between them? If he's
she's
in college, he was back from school or something?
I don't know how old she's supposed to be.
I think she's probably supposed to be late 20s.
At the youngest, yeah.
How old is George supposed
to be?
He's
in his 30s. It's 30-something at this
probably
point.
Probably younger than we are right now.
That's weird to think about. Probably.
Oh, God. Don't do that.
Yeah, enjoy that beer.
They've aged her up, but I was watching an old episode of The Simpsons where Marge identifies herself as being 34. I was like, nope. That's weird. Okay.
I remember when I was Bart's age. I remember watching that. I was just like, we're the same age.
Yeah, when it started, I was Bart's age.
I was Lisa's age when it started, and then I passed up all of them, and now I'm older than everyone but, like, Grandpa, which, terrifying. So the brother is played by Timothy Omudson. I don't know how to pronounce that last name. And this is his first acting role ever. He played Kane on Supernatural.
Okay.
And he looks like, he looks like a wizard now or like a king. He played a king on that show Gallivant. That was on ABC for a little bit.
Oh yeah. He was the villain, wasn't he?
I don't know. He was the king. I didn't actually watch it, which probably didn't help it. I got canceled.
Many people did not.
Yeah. But he got like 2 seasons though, right?
Yeah.
Good for them. He was also one of the main detectives on that show Psych.
Yeah.
Which did a Twin Peaks episode called Dual Spires, where they go to a town that's like Twin Peaks and a bunch of actors from the original show do riffs on their original characters, but neither Warren Frost nor Grace Zabriskie actually appear in that episode.
That seems like a wasted opportunity.
Everyone else is like Log Lady's there, Audrey's there, Laura's there. They have most of them there.
Hmm. I actually recognize him in every role that you have listed.
He looks dramatically different now. He kind of looks the same on Psych, but like, yeah, he has a very dramatic facial hair now. His acting career turned out very well. Do either of you guys have the term we have is reach around. It's where we like do a deep reach to make a metaphorical connection for something.
Okay.
What do you guys make of Aunt Sarah's dirty wheels tracking mud through the house?
Sarah, what do you have on your wheels?
Nothing. They're clean.
Ricky, did you wipe her wheels off?
Yes.
Well, they're filthy. It's just a matter of common courtesy. You come in the house, you wipe your wheels.
Oh, like her dirty, like we got the dirty secret ruining all this.
I like that.
Yeah. The mom's preoccupation with that seems very Twin Peaks to me. Like she was like really offended about like wheels bringing dirt into her house and she wanted the...
Also, okay, this
is... carpet.
So this is the aunt and now her daughter's bringing in another person that looks like this woman that she hates bringing dirt into this house.
Quite literally. At first, it's a dirty... The doorman shows up with a dirty ash-covered metal box and they open it up and what's inside is even worse.
Even dirtier.
The actress's reading of the letter is perfect. The pause right before I fear your orgasm left me a cripple. That's...
And again, there's a cripple in the room.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really awkward. Oh, no. That's extra awkward.
Do you think that's how she got that?
Yeah, she came.
She orgasmed her legs loose.
Real but, hard.
Like, vertebrae just brother. Popped.
Then he says, I don't know how I'll ever get back to work, which I want to tie it in with their procrastination with not being able to write in this episode. Mm-hmm. There's another through line. I love you madly, John. P.S. Love the cabin. So he comes in and he's horrified. The dad is horrified that everyone knows about his gay affair with
famous author.
Famous author John Cheever.
Fox! My letters! Give me that! Who told you to open it?
Who's John? Who's John?
I knew it!
John Cheever dead! You and John Cheever?
Yes! Yes, he was the most wonderful person I've ever known. And I loved him deeply. In a way you could never understand.
What do you guys know about John Cheever?
I only know that he wrote whatever book that George was reading in the next scene. It's the only from context of who is an author. That's all I know from that.
The book is Falconer. It's about a guy who goes to jail for murdering his brother and has an affair with a male inmate.
There we go.
Mm-hmm. He writes a lot about duality.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
I read The Swimmer, which is the movie that inspired that Burt Lancaster movie. And it's this very odd story about a man who decides he's going to go leave a party by swimming through every pool as he goes home. And it's very surreal and interesting. And everything he writes sort of feels like it exists in like the Austening of Mad Men. He lived in Austening, New York. And it's that very particular sort of like rich, drunk, sad person. He was a very sad man. He was not okay. He was not well.
So the way you describe that, I saw it like a Hockney painting.
Sort of.
Yeah. I mean, he's going actually, all those yes. pools. That's
not an inappropriate way to look at it, given John Cheever's personal life. He was married to a woman. He had a lot of affairs with men. He was very conflicted about it. It made me think of the line at the beginning of the episode where they talk, Jerry and George talk about like, we could build a cabin. And Jerry's like,
men can,
but not us. John Cheever had a very specific idea about what a man was. And whether or not he was that and what other people were. So he had a lot of sex with men, was not okay with it. Like, he was very conflicted about it. He was a horrible alcoholic. And
again, alcoholism.
I mean, rich wafts. So like, yeah. Yes. But so you did not read the Guardian article about it. So they did. His daughter wrote a book about his life. And it includes excerpts from journals. And one of the excerpts is... This is a paragraph from the Guardian article. In his journals, fear of homosexuality manifests itself in the form of homophobia. Cheever would often describe his distaste for gay men, who he regarded as effeminate, even obscene. As for the idea of waking up with a man, quote, it's one thing to tear off a merry piece behind the barn with a goat herd, but one wouldn't, once your lump is blown, want to take it any further.
Speaking of dirty talk.
I know. It says, after a night spent with the writer Calvin Kentfield, he was so filled with self-loathing, he became temporarily agoraphobic. It's a weird divide. I mean, I can't imagine what it was like to have like homosexual urges at that point, because it would have been much more difficult than it was now. But like, it is weird to have people separate between.
That's why we had Fire Island. That's really how that started.
Is it really?
Oh my God, to get away from, well, it was illegal to be gay then. And there were a lot of places, except for bars that were backed by the mafia, go to this island where there's no cops.
But that goes back to ancient Greece. Like, it's okay to like fuck a man during war, but it's another thing like.
Go Sparta.
Yeah.
Like, you still have a wife and like, yeah.
So it's only really very recent history where like gay people are allowed to be all types and live all kinds of lives.
You get to pick what you want, not feel quite as terrible about it.
I mean, in some parts of the world.
In some parts of the world.
Yeah. Oh, before we go past the family, though, can we talk about the reoccurring theme of terrible younger brothers of George's girlfriends?
Yeah, I was thinking the double dipping.
The double dip. Timmy.
Oh.
This isn't the first time that we met a terrible younger brother of one of George's girlfriends.
Is that when
Megan Mullally?
They're at the funeral.
Yeah, when he flies to the funeral.
Oh, that is Megan Mullally.
Yeah.
See, he has another
example. Deaf in like one ear or something, and so he can't do his move.
I'm trying to think of anyone. Like, no one else has younger siblings on the show. None of the main four characters have any siblings, right?
Nope.
No.
Huh, that's weird.
No. That is weird.
It's why they're such selfish people.
Yeah, they're all only children.
And we've met all of at least one parent of each.
Yeah, so Elaine mentions her mom at the end of this episode, but we never see her mom, correct?
Nope. We meet the dad once. And he's also homophobic.
And like terrifying.
Like, yeah.
And then we never meet Kramer's dad.
I don't think he knows his dad, and I don't think his mother knows his dad. It's
like a Maury Povich.
It's
special.
Highly implied that she was a whore.
Okay.
She's promiscuous.
She's promiscuous.
Sex having person.
She made herself available.
Liberal.
I love Aunt Sarah's reaction as everyone. So everyone finds out.
I knew it.
I knew it. And she's like grinning like evilly. Like she's, you get the idea that this paraplegic woman is as awful as anyone else.
Do you think Susan's with George because she has been so like, almost like a Stockholm syndrome of terrible people growing up that she actively finds terrible men because that's the only way she's conditioned to know love?
There's no other explanation for why she would enter a relationship with George at least three times.
Re-enter, yeah.
Yeah, like this poor woman.
She was going to lock that down.
And she would have had it not killed her.
Yes.
Yeah. The dad says, he was the most wonderful person I've ever known. And I loved him deeply in a way you will never understand. To his wife, which is a very mean thing to do. I don't think John Cheever would have actually shared those feelings back at him because based on what I read, he did not think it was okay to actually love another man.
But. So his kids knew because they're like, they knew who he was. But she says, who's John?
Yeah.
Is it knowingly who's John admit it or
maybe she didn't know who John
maybe
was
just drunk, but they seem like they knew him like as an Uncle John kind of thing.
The way the son reacts,
it sound like he knew it personally.
Maybe he just,
it was an interesting scene that way where it's not that they knew him because he was this published author. They knew Uncle John, like something like that.
But it's like also familiar. So much of what Seinfeld is like these actually interesting, very deeply personal stories are just like throwaway jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And like the main conflict of the episode is really like they should be writing.
And they weasel out of it. They don't stay to see how this plays out any further. They're like, we should go.
Yeah.
And
the actual drama holds no interest to them.
Nope. No.
They always just let a grenade off in a room and they back out.
And then they're back trying to write again at Jerry's apartment.
And they aren't inspired in any way
by
any of this happening. They don't see any opportunity of putting any of this in a script.
That is an interesting point that like they just don't seem to think any of it's interesting because they don't want to be around it and they feel uncomfortable having
witnessed
it.
Because they have zero sense of empathy.
True.
Cannot see a world through anyone else's eyes but their own.
So Elaine comes in after that and she's like,
real good!
What?
You know how much money you cost me today? $29.
What? How?
I got Sandra transferred to another office upstairs, okay? So she blabs to Lippman about my long-distance calls to Europe.
What calls?
Oh, I made a friend when I was in Europe, okay? And we've been in touch, and Sandra told Lippman.
Oh, did she say anything else to you?
Anything else? What do you mean anything else?
So she just left the office, didn't say a word to you about anything?
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Which is not a plotline that ever, we don't find out who that is. It's not like.
I don't remember her ever going to Europe.
She went, no.
With
she,
her
that
psychiatrist?
Was a big thing. Yeah,
she
that did. Was a huge thing with Crazy Joe Davola.
Oh,
the whole
yeah.
reason that he went off right. his meds is because Elaine went to Europe with his psychiatrist and that's what turned him crazy.
And the next episode is the opera where Joe Davola comes back dressed as whatever.
Pagliacci.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So that's weird. And then she makes Jerry pay. And
$427, which was a lot in the 90s.
That's a lot of long distance. I mean, the assumption is that like Sandra squealed on her because she's mad about the entire.
Yeah. Because she's a drama queen. She
Is there anything else before the big finale of this scene?
I mean, I forget which
I love the way that Julie Louis-Dreyfus plays that too. She plays Jerry. Yeah. I think she's fantastic. She's so talented.
She manipulates him to pay for her. I forget which Kramer entrance it was, but it reminded me of whenever Thurman comes into a room and we both are just very excited to see him.
Yes.
It's the way that
Thurman is my dog.
Aww.
Oh, hey.
Hey!
Hey! You guys are working. I'll come back.
No. Come on.
Nah, you guys should get back to work.
No, don't leave. We're taking a break.
So I can like, see
you. Oh, it's Thurman. Thurman, no, come here. No, come here. No. Okay, you're leaving. Okay. Right. You're not getting up here. Okay. Yeah. He's very special. Yeah, I agree with that. I also love the way
adorable
Julie Louis-Dreyfus sells the scene. Like the end line.
All right, look, we got to get back to work. We just had a big breakthrough here.
Okay, I'll leave you two alone.
Okay.
Maybe I'll go visit my mother. She just bought me some new panties and they're all laid out for me.
Thank you.
big reaction from the audience. The audience, like, the audience thinks it's funnier than I do. And I was like, okay, I get it. It's like good closure, but the audience like loses their shit.
That might have been like the shot. Like, they may not have done the joke until they knew they could do the joke and get that audience reaction.
That's true. That's not something you can really get more than once without a brand new audience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a very good moment. She's perfect in it.
They do three camera comedy perfectly.
They're really dope. This is a really good episode. And the last time we did a Seinfeld, I was like, I was not moved.
What was the last one you did?
The one where Jerry and George get mistaken for being gay.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
And
so
that,
90s.
That one was like, whatever. This one I actually enjoyed quite a bit. And I like that it like is a big part of Seinfeld universe.
I like it's never brought up ever again. We meet this man again. This is a huge bomb that they threw in his life. And he's still with her.
Still married. Maybe they
use miserable
the revelation of his sexuality to open up dialogue between them and they hate each other less. Or maybe they just hate George.
They bonded with that. Their mutual hatred of this man.
He may be bisexual and able to love his wife just as much as he loved John.
I don't think there's no love in that relationship.
Maybe there's just sex. Drunk old person sex.
Drunk old hot dry sex.
Yeah. The last time we see them is in the series finale when the verdict comes in and the four main characters are found guilty. They are overjoyed and they don't ever express this quite as plainly as they do in that moment. But I think they very much so blame George for the death of Susan and they hate him. So
well, everyone said that. They actually said that line.
Oh,
remember when
the foundation.
So George tries getting out of something with the foundation, talking about he's getting something in the Hamptons. Mm. And then, of course, Elaine, 5 seconds later, after he leaves, blabs, he doesn't have something in the Hamptons. And I love I told him I have a place in the Hamptons. What do you tell him? I told him you didn't, she says with complete glee at ruining this. So he has to like fake that he's bringing it there. And they're like, yeah, let's go. Let's check this out. So he just keeps bringing them up to Long Island. And eventually he has to admit he didn't do it. We know. Why? Why would you let me do this? Because we blame you for Susan's death.
Oh, I don't.
They literally say that line.
Well, there's also the scene with the foundation where after George leaves the room, because he's convinced that they all think he killed Susan. Mm-hmm. And after his plan to find out if that's what they think fails, like they do this all say, like, so we all agree that it was the dad from Harry and the Hendersons. The TV
okay.
series,
yeah.
Slash Senator Kelly.
So wait, is that the one where he puts the tape recorder in the briefcase? Yeah. And there's that mystery
thump?
That is never... Like, and then someone yells, oh, God, or my God, or something.
Yeah. Somebody fell backwards in a chair, right?
Yeah, someone fell.
Oh, I thought that was never solved. Okay, so clearly these later seasons I do not remember as well as the earlier part.
It's a little different show after season 6.
No, that's, I guess.
And aesthetically, it looks different, too.
Mm-hmm.
They stopped doing stand-up to bookend the episode.
Which I like. And then also, Elaine's appearance changes, and that's the biggest demarcation for me. It's like, oh, this is a later Seinfeld.
Yeah, she doesn't have the poof anymore.
No, she's like standard
hot. And the clothes are, like, a lot better looking.
Yeah. She wears like a leather jacket.
She wears like actual suits.
Yeah.
Yeah. What she wears in this episode, I can't even explain it. It's like a giant frilly collar. And it's like, even in the 90s, I don't think that was okay.
Like, I feel like there's
Did her mother lay that out for her?
I feel like there was like, what would an editor wear? Someone who loves books. And they forgot that like editor was probably a very sexy position in New York in the 90s.
Probably. Or maybe they just thought that was actually
early
sexy.
90s fashion was a little weird.
Well, yeah.
Think about like they took a lot of swings back then.
Yeah.
A lot of misses.
Like my touchstones are like early Seinfeld and also Twin Peaks, where like a lot of the stuff the girls wear, I'm like, that's weird.
But yeah, it was very short skirts, but like long sleeves, like layered, like boots. Hot dress, but then like a sweater underneath. It was weird.
Like floral dresses and boots.
Yeah.
Which I associate specifically with Shannon Doherty.
Blossom hats. Yes. Yeah. Anything Shannon Doherty would wear would be quintessentially 90s.
No.
And she still kind of wears sometimes.
Any further thoughts about this episode? Guest, Mike Siriaco.
Okay. I just love that once again, we never, ever see some of these characters ever. They throw them in there for one scene.
Mm-hmm.
They do their job and they probably just died somehow by just knowing Seinfeld and the gang.
Right.
They probably just fucking died.
That's fair.
Yeah.
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 I just really hope that the B plot of the Dirty Talk was intentional to mirror the love letters.
We try not to read authorial intent too much, but like there is so much repetition and thematic like pattern in all these episodes that it would be very surprising if someone was not aware of this. And also, The teleplay is by Larry David. So this is probably all stuff that would have been added by him, because it's not the stuff that would have been established in a story necessarily. Mm-hmm. So it might be that Larry David is really good at creating like these nicely architectured plots.
Well, he is.
I just don't know that much about it. If you asked me which episodes Larry himself wrote, I wouldn't know off the top of my head. This is the one I actually know.
Do you not watch Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I find it very difficult to watch because Larry David is a painful character to be around.
It's hard to watch him. Like, I can't binge Larry David.
No. Like, you just see, like, my skin feels wrong after doing that.
It's always fun, though, when he appears on Seinfeld. It's rare, but once in a while, you'll see, or at least his hands. Mm-hmm.
Would you be able to stand Dirty Talk in a Larry David voice?
Yes. No.
Are those the panties your mother laid out for you? No. Oh, my God.
He probably had to speak that line out loud.
Thank God he has money. It's the only way he probably gets laid.
I feel like there's enough people who are turned on by creative genius that they wouldn't care about the money, and the money would just be a nice benefit. I say, hoping that somewhere down the road when I am like an 80-year-old man, someone loves me for my mind and not my money.
That is true. I remember I did an indie movie years ago, and one of the actresses, because it was an eccentric, not that good-looking kind of director, and she was hooking up with him. I remember she said, she's like, his looks don't matter. He's a creative genius. I don't care that he's not good looking. She's obviously not a gay man.
This conversation doesn't make me think of the episode where Elaine sets George up with her friend. I think her name is Sienna. And it's Katie Silverstone, who played Drew Carey's girlfriend on the first season of Drew Carey. And someone I've always liked as an actress. I don't know what she's doing now. But Elaine and her have an art class together. And she's like, how is your date with George? And she says, like, offhand, like, I don't even care about good looks. And then Elaine repeats that part. And George is devastated to hear that, like, this woman who's interested in him does not care about.
Fun fact, I actually did the exact same thing by accident to the director.
Oh, no.
Without realizing, like, oh, this is totally going to hurt his feelings. I thought I was delivering good news.
I can see.
I can see Elaine's thing. Like, it's okay. Like, I guess it's that thing we all thought we knew how you looked.
Yeah, you look like shit. My closing thought is about the production title that appears at the end of this episode, which is Castle Rock Entertainment. I did not put this together in my head until now, but Castle Rock is the Stephen King universe town that, like, is that the name of the show on Hulu?
Castle Rock, yes.
Castle Rock. So I looked it up and I'm like, why is this production company called Castle Rock? It was co-founded by a bunch of people, including Rob Reiner, who named the company Castle Rock after the Stephen King town.
Why?
He liked the way it sounded, I guess. I can't figure out why.
Which reminds me of Game of Thrones, Castle Rock.
Is that
the
where the Lannisters.
The Lannisters live at Castle Rock.
Castle Rock.
Yep.
I love the Game of Thrones, like, linguistic modification of, like, we're going to put one extra letter in there and all of a sudden it's become fantastical. We're going to spell Sir S-E-R and it's going to be a whole different thing.
Give us your money.
Yeah. Well, it's not going to work now.
No. Ugh, they ruined that.
Mr. Siriaco, if people want to follow you on social media, where might they be able to find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Mike Siriaco, MikeCiriaco, or on Instagram at MikeCiriaco2099. Some motherfucker got Mike Siriaco first on that.
Is there another Mike Siriaco?
There are many Mike Siriacos. It's weird.
One might say too many.
Far too many. We just need the one.
Glenn?
You can find me on Twitter at I Write Wrongs. That is I write with a W and then wrongs with a W. I spelled it.
You spelled it. Good for you. He hasn't spelled it for a while.
There you go.
I don't like spelling in person out loud. And Instagram at Bros Quartz, B-R-O-S Quartz.
And I am Drew Mackey. You can find me at Drew G Mackey on Twitter, M-A-C-K-I-E. And you can follow this podcast on Twitter at Gayest Episode. Listen to all previous episodes at GayestEpisodeEver.com. Please donate to our Patreon, as we mentioned earlier, patreon.com/GayestEpisodeEver. Our logo is designed by Rob Wilson. Please check out his work at robwilsonwork.com. And this is a Table Cakes podcast. Table Cakes is a Los Angeles-based podcast network, and you can find out more about the Table Cakes show by going to tablecakes.com.
I know you had me a cake.
I know.
Oh, and check me out at WeHo TV News.
Just Google WeHo TV News.
Just Google WeHo TV News. You'll find it.
You're an anchor.
Yes, I am. And head writer. And
ooh, you write the news?
Yeah. I make it interesting.
Better journalist than me. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having
us.
This
joining
was a
us.
Blast.
Jesus.
My homework was watching Hulu.
This was a joy to do. Podcast over?
Bye forever.
Podcast over.
Bye.
a Table Cakes production.
Guess we should just get this over with.
Just hold on a minute. Still one short.
Oh. No, we're not.
Susie has been very rude to me.
Well, Elaine has nothing but good things to say about Susie.
Look, we don't have to name names or point fingers or name names. Me and her have had our problems. She and I have had our problems. You and I, and she and you.
Don't you drag me into this. This is between you and her and her.
Yes, and I'm convinced that if she were here with us today, she would agree with me too.
Who?
Her?
Where is she?
This is part of the problem.
I thought I was part of this problem.
You're a huge part of the problem. But I think that at its core, this is a Susie and Elaine problem that requires a Susie and Elaine solution. And who better to do that than Elaine and Susie, Susie and Elaine.
Well, now that we have that cleared up, why don't the three of us have lunch?
What? Oh, I'm coming. I gotta go.
She is the best. What was your name again?